Dave.
Thank you. Afternoon, everybody. My original title was Experimental Summary, but I thought it would be a bit rich to summarize a conference, most of which I didn't attend. I apologize for that. I had intended to attend the entire conference, but when they made me a director, I assumed that the title director meant I got to direct people. But as you all know, directing particle physicists is a pretty pointless thing to do. And I discovered the reason I was called a director is because everybody got to direct me. And so I was directed to be in Tokyo at the beginning of the week. And so sadly, I missed the beginning of the conference. I have, however, gone through all the slides which are on the web. And I did something else, which is I thought that trying to summarize a conference you attended and I didn't would put me in a relatively poor position when it came to questions. And so what I did is I went through the NNN conference, which was also held this week, and I've picked a bunch of stuff out of the NNN conference, so at least we're even. You know, none of us attended that conference. So, neutrino physics. Why am I a neutrino physicist, and why is it an exciting thing to be a neutrino physicist, and why should we keep being neutrino physicists? To answer that question, I'd like to go back to 1981. Unfortunately, Peter left. He's heard enough of my talks. When I was a graduate student at Caltech, just a few miles from here, in 1981, I had my first course on the Standard Model from Barry Barish, and we learned the Standard Model. And I, not that long ago, I pulled out the notebook from that course, and there, drawn on the page, was this exact diagram, not of course with the snazzy Fermilab graphics, just in pencil, with all the same components. We had these six quarks and the six leptons and the four-gauge bosons, and of course we can't forget the Higgs. And this was, in the Standard Model that we have today, that we learned back then, 33 years ago. Of course, it was a bit of a stretch to write all this down, because of course at that time nobody had ever seen a tau lepton, in the sense of nobody had seen an event with a tau lepton in the initial state, although we of course had seen the missing energy and momentum, which is the usual indication that there's a neutrino around. Nobody had seen a top quark, no direct experimental evidence of the Z or the W boson, and of course no one had seen a Higgs. In 1981, on the facing page to this was what we knew about neutrinos. And in 1981, what was written in my book was that there are three neutrinos. They have a conserved lepton flavor number, so once you make a nu e, a nu mu, or a nu tau, that's what you're stuck with. They are strictly massless, and they were strictly left-handed. Okay. So now, in the 33 years that have passed, what have we accomplished? If we skip forward to today, right? Well, the UA1 and the UA2 experiments at CERN discovered experimental evidence for the Z boson and the W. And then at Fermilab, they found the top at CDF, and Donut found the new tau. And for anybody who's spent the last several years at the bottom of the ocean or in a cave, I'll tell you that a couple of years ago, they managed to find the Higgs boson. So there we are. In the 33 years, what we did is we got rid of the little red circles. And other than that, it looks just the same as it did then. This, on the other hand, is all crap. Okay. So what we've accomplished in the last 33 years on that side, right, is a complete transformation of what we believe to be true about neutrinos. So I'm rather pleased that I went to work on this side of the puzzle in 1981. But we're not done yet. As you heard at this conference and many other times, we can't understand particle physics without understanding neutrinos, but we aren't finished yet. We have by no means completed this transformation. And we will not get this information from any other source. We must build more neutrino experiments. No amount of running of the LHC, if you build an ILC, if you build an FCC, none of this is going to get you the information we need. So we have no choice. We either give up or we build more neutrino experiments. So for the young people in the audience, there's work to be had. Right. So of course, you know, over that period, at the time when I, actually when I started, the only experiment that we had was, the only experiment relevant to this story, of course there were the neutrino experiments, but the only experiment relevant to this story we had was the chlorine experiment, the Davis experiment, or the experimental suppression of the solar electron neutrino flux had already been observed. And since then, of course, this one, Kamioka, came in while I was still in graduate school, but all the subsequent ones have happened since. And when we take the results from all of these experiments and we add to it all the ones that we have added since, we add to this results from Sho, Palo Verde, K to K, Minos, Minos Plus, T to K, Diabe, Reno, Double Sho, Borax, Eno, Opera, Icarus, Ice Cube, Antares, and with more yet to come. We heard that very shortly NOVA will be added to this list. It's already got events. And very shortly we will add it to the list of ones that have measured things. And when we add all that together, we now have the model of three neutrino flavor oscillations, where the three angles are now all fairly well determined. We have, you know, first, of course, let's not minimize the accomplishment. We've proven that neutrinos oscillate. And then in addition to that, we have demonstrated, we have been able to measure the values of all the mixing angles and the delta M squareds. Unfortunately, we have this problem here in that we don't know the sign of this delta M squared because we've never observed a matter effect on that. So that is, you know, what we say. You know, we don't know the hierarchy. We don't know the sign of that delta M squared. We would like to know the value of theta 2, 3 better, as was mentioned in several talks already today. The uncertainty in that is damaging our ability to measure the various other things, as well as, of course, it's very interesting to know whether theta 2, 3 is this special value of maximum mixing or some other. Actually, that's not, as I discovered working on T decay, that's not maximum mixing point. The maximum mixing is actually, if you put the full three neutrinos in, is actually displaced a bit to the right from there. But 0.5 is the value, the special value for the mixing angle. Is it equal to that, or is it off? And if it is off, in which direction? And of course, what is the value of the CP violating phase delta, which is still at 3 sigma unconstrained on this plot? Okay. And so before we can really be said to have determined the properties of neutrino oscillations, at absolute minimum, we have to answer these three questions. Now, I want to take a brief digression, and I would be interested in the discussion to follow if anybody has a better reason, because I am routinely, when making neutrino physics presentations to other types of particle physicists, you know, in particular ones that want the money that we would spend on a neutrino experiment, take a look at this and say, CP violated in neutrino oscillations, well, you know, isn't delta just a number? You know, why are we bothered? Why do we want to measure delta? And some of them are especially rich coming from some of these CERN people. They say, well, you know, we measured the CP phase in the CKM matrix and it never really told us anything. So, you know, we shouldn't bother to measure it in the neutrino sector. What are we going to learn? Well, I don't believe that's a valid argument, obviously. I wouldn't be planning to spend the rest of my career trying to do it. Okay, so here are my three main reasons, and I'm happy to hear others. To me, it's a very interesting question. You know, we see that we have sort of, you know, three places, three interactions in nature, right, where CP could have been violated, right? Now, it can't be violated in electromagnetism because it's protected, right? But it's not protected in the strong interaction, right? And yet it appears to be zero, right? Or it's 10 to the minus 10, right, based on the neutron EDM. The other place it could have been non-zero is in the weak interactions of quarks, you know, the phase in the CKM matrix, and that's not zero, that's 72 degrees, so it's sort of as big as it could have been. Everybody seems to think, right, that the odd case is the strong interaction. They say, well, gosh, how can that be zero, right? So they invent axions or something to protect it. And they think that there's no need to explain the case of the weak CP phase because it's just a number and, well, wouldn't it be? But I don't know that that's true. Maybe CP is a protected symmetry of nature and the weird one is the weak phase. So, you know, whether delta is zero or not seems to me to be a very interesting piece of information in trying to figure out which of these is the one that needs explaining it. Is it the strong phase being zero that needs to be explained, or is it the weak phase not being zero that needs to be explained? Two, of course, surely the origin of matter in the universe is a fundamental question that must be answered, and delta is one of the few windows we may have into it. If a model, which I will not name here for the fear of starting another big discussion right in the middle of my talk, but if that model that was being discussed earlier is true, then delta may be one of the few windows we have into it. So we should certainly attempt to experimentally determine it. And then what I usually just say to the people at CERN is I say, well, the mass of Higgs is just a number. Right? So if you can just measure numbers, I can just measure numbers. Right? I mean, this is nonsense to me. I mean, what do particle physicists do? We determine these numbers, which are, as far as we can tell, fundamental constants of nature. So I don't understand this argument, basically. Right. So what else do we need to do? We want to know if neutrinos are their own antiparticles. That might be the most interesting question on the list, actually. We need to know the absolute masses of neutrinos, which you can't get out of oscillation experiments. Actually, I said that at a talk, some Eastern European university, I can't remember which one, and some guy sort of harumphed when I said this, and after the talk said, you haven't read my paper. Oh, I'm sorry. And he gave me this handwritten note with the reference to it. And it wasn't an archive reference, of course, it was a reference from the journal, and he handed it to me. And because I had said you can't measure absolute masses in neutrino oscillations. I'm very sorry, I mean, you know, because A, you know, I didn't think you could. And so I promptly ran off to the library and read his paper. And he demonstrated a way you could measure absolute masses with an oscillation experiment, provided that you measured the oscillation of supernova neutrinos that had gone through a gravitational lens. So I stand corrected. It would be very difficult to measure the absolute mass of neutrinos from oscillation experiments. Are three neutrinos all there are, or are there sterile neutrinos as well? Are there any other surprises? You know, almost everything that's happened in neutrino physics, you know, every time we discover something, it's almost always a surprise. So maybe there are some more out there. Right, but also we have this exciting prospect of using neutrinos as probes, which of course is what Ray was trying to do when we got into this mess. So probe the sun, probe the Earth for geoneutrinos, probe supernova, probe nuclei, so I'll come back to, and of course probing the most energetic places in the universe, the places where presumably cosmic rays are made. So this is sort of a partial list of, you know, because I've left off some various things here, like the electromagnetic properties of neutrinos and so forth for a half an hour talk. This is a partial list of some of the things we'll have to do to keep us busy. So first, let's talk about the absolute masses of neutrinos. You had a talk already on this incredibly impressive experiment, the Catrin Karlsruhe tritium experiment, the usual picture of this being hauled through a town. And I actually saw this last autumn. It's an incredibly impressive technical achievement. It's a beautiful experiment. It should someday reach about 0.2 electron volts, and the exciting news is it's beginning to take data. This is the segmented detector, and they have an electron gun so they can fire an electron beam into various bits of the phase space, and this sort of proves that if you start it in the right bit of the phase space, it finishes in the right bit of the phase space. made themselves a smiley face. This is a real tour de force. However, it's sort of a development of ideas that have been in the field for a very long time. I worked on the tritium beta decay experiment at Los Alamos 30 years ago, which was conceptually fairly similar to this, except instead of the Mackey filter, it just had a giant orange spectrometer. To me, one of the most exciting ideas I've heard in this for ages, this idea for Project 8, and I won't go through it because you heard about it earlier in the week, this idea of measuring the energy of individual electrons by observing the synchrotron radiation they emit, or the cyclotron radiation they emit in a magnetic field when they're at very low energies. And so you see an electron here, and you measure its frequency, and as it loses energy in the gas, the frequency shifts, and then occasionally it scatters to lower energy, and you get these jumps. So the idea of measuring an electron energy is finding that point. And here's a spectrum of every tritium beta decay person's favorite weird isotope, krypton 83, an isomer that produces these nice calibration lines. So it's absolutely stunning that this thing actually works. And on paper, at least, it should be possible with this to actually produce an experiment with a greater intrinsic sensitivity than Catrin, something you'll never do by the conventional technique, because, you know, unless they start building German towns with wider streets, this is the largest spectrometer you can really build. And you're limited by the laws of physics. This is not, you know, it's not sheer brute force that made them build it this big. Basically, Liouville's theorem, you know, says that if you start with the electrons going in all directions, and you have to line them up when they come through here to get the energy analyzed, then the minimum ratio size of that to that is sort of the ratio of the angles you're going to accept. So basically, this has to be much bigger than this, that diameter of the source, and the diameter of the source can't be made any smaller because you need a lot of strength, you need a lot of intensity, but you can't make the source thick, right? Because otherwise the energy will be lost in the source and you destroy the resolution. So you're just screwed. You've got to make it bigger. Project 8 gets around that because now you're measuring the energy of the electrons within this tritium, and so you're no longer limited by the area of the tritium source but by its volume. So you can make the whole thing much smaller. So this is really exciting, and an idea that I had not seen presented before this conference, and of course I didn't see it presented in this conference, but I saw it on the transparencies, is the idea of using Catrin as an injector to Project 8. So one of the problems with Project 8, of course, is it's only the very tiny endpoint, you know, part 10 to the 13 at the end of the spectrum that has information about the neutrino mass, the rest of it sort of wasted. And if you just have bulk tritium in your detector, then you've got this rate problem. You have these huge rate of uninteresting decays. So this would be a way to cut the uninteresting decays out before you get into the spectrometer. Sort of an interesting idea. Now this next one has nothing whatsoever to do with this conference, but I just thought it was the coolest picture I've seen in a long time, so I came up with a totally specious justification for showing it here. Catrin shows the power of resolution, so does this. Brought to you by the British taxpayer. This is the new ALMA, submillimeter array in Chile, which has produced an interferometer array, of course. It's produced a new image of the star system HL Tau, a young star system about 450 light years from Earth. So that's about an AU, an astronomical unit. And you see this is the accretion disk around HL Tau, and you can see these dark bands where there are planets, new protoplanets, sweeping out the gas and dust out of the disk. So this is the first time we've imaged a solar system, well, not a solar system, of course, it's not the sun, but a stellar system of planets. Cool. And in another advertisement for the British taxpayer, the American taxpayer as well, of course, on Tuesday you can watch Rosetta land on a planet, a comet. Well, I hope. Or you can watch Rosetta miss a comet at tremendous expense, one of the others. Back to neutrino physics. What are the absolute masses of neutrinos? We also can determine the absolute masses of neutrinos from astrophysics. I very much like this plot. I wish I'd been here to see it, because it looked like it was a nice talk. But this shows, as a function of how many, what you put into the model and which data you use, different authors derive different limits for the astrophysical for the neutrino masses from astrophysical data. And of course, as you put in more and more data, you would think things would get better, but in fact, you have to make more and more assumptions to connect them. And so as you go further out in this direction with more models and more data, down here where you're using only a little data and not much in the way of models, you're on solid ground. But as you go up here, it becomes quite shaky. And yet, when you read descriptions of the future, people talk about achieving sensitivities to neutrino masses, which are orders of magnitude better than this, despite the fact that the current limits vary over orders of magnitude. So I have nothing has altered my opinion, which I've expressed many times, which is I don't think that you should be extracting neutrino masses from cosmological data. Cosmological data is rare and valuable stuff, which is the only thing we have to learn about cosmology. And so neutrino properties, which is something that if we get off our butts and do it, we ought to be able to measure on the Earth. And so we should determine them here and use them as inputs to cosmology, not outputs. Right, and how else will we get the absolute masses of neutrinos? Well, this is coupled to whether neutrinos are their own antiparticles, which of course is a search for neutrinoless double beta decay. Very nice talk by Steve, which I wish I would have heard, going through the very large number of current running experiments which are producing interesting new data on neutrinoless double beta decay. And I have no time to repeat all of this, but you all know the story. We are pushing down our sensitivity to M beta beta with new experiments. I got this slide off of a SNOW talk, so obviously a SNOW Plus talk emphasizes SNOW Plus. There are quite a number of other experiments. And we hope in the this generation and one more generation of experiments, hopefully to get down here around 10 to minus 2, 10 milli electron volts, the bottom of this inverted hierarchy region. And if we reach that, we have a sort of almost no lose scenario, because the two mass hierarchies here, inverted and normal, can be measured independently, and we'll come back later, just a minute, how that's done. And so we should know on roughly the time scale we get down here whether we're in the normal or the inverted hierarchy from independent means, and then we either will or we won't have seen zero neutrino double beta decay. If we have seen zero neutrino double beta decay and we know we're in the inverted hierarchy, great. We know we're here somewhere. If we haven't seen double beta decay and we know we're in the inverted hierarchy, then we know if there are only three neutrinos in the world, I'll come back to that in a moment, then neutrinos are Dirac, because we probed the bottom of the parameter space that's allowed, and we didn't see double beta decay, so we would know neutrinos are Dirac. So that's a win as well. We've determined something fundamental. Of course, the big banana, the great one, is if we have measured that the hierarchy is normal and we see neutrinoless double beta decay. Because if our sensitivity is across here and we've measured neutrinoless double beta decay and we know we're in the normal hierarchy, then we're somewhere in this bit of the curve, which means not only have we measured the M beta beta, we've also determined a lower limit for the mass of the lightest neutrino state. So we've in some sense measured all the properties of neutrino masses then. So that wouldn't be great. Of course, the unfortunate one is if it's normal hierarchy and we haven't seen neutrinoless double beta decay, which means we could be down here somewhere. And in that case, we'll need a bigger experiment. Okay, so we should make sure we are indeed to be ready. Many, many experiments, which I have no time to discuss, are pushing ahead with that. And all we can really do is help them in this sense, well, those of us who aren't working on it, we must have multiple experiments because, you know, one, just to prove that what we're actually seeing is neutrinos double beta decay, but also to these problems with estimating the matrix elements. So we have to keep making this point to the experiment. I've had, and we even have to spell agencies correctly to convince them. I've had to do this myself in the UK, because quite often the agencies, when they hear that there's 19 different double beta decay experiments, they say, well, which one's best? And you say, well, you can't really say which one's best. And they say, oh, well, then you're not ready to do the experiment yet, right? Because, you know, if you were really ready to do the experiment, you'd know which one was best. You say, well, no, it doesn't work that way. And so you have to be careful to keep banging on them to realize that we will need many of these experiments, and so we have to maintain funding. Steve put up this, I hadn't seen this one before, Steve put up this very nice optimistic plot showing that if you look, the mass limit is a function of time, it's dropping down like this. I kind of worry about these plots as a guy who did a neutron electric dipole moment for many years, because this kind of creates the belief in the funding agency's mind that they don't have to do anything, right? You just go away and come back 10 years from now and it'll be down here. Uh-oh. So such plots are reassuring. They don't spontaneously arise. They can stall, as the similar plot for the neutron EDM has for decades now. So progress will only continue if we support new ideas and new people and keep steady pressure on the funding agencies for resources, right? And this is a plot I picked out in NNN14. This is probably well known to the theorists here in the audience. But if you go from a three neutrino model to a sterile neutrino model, a model with sterile neutrinos, surprisingly enough, this picture changes radically. Now it's the inverted hierarchy that can go to zero anywhere, and your predictive power becomes much less. And so we'd better find out if we have any sterile neutrinos. So you've all seen these evidences before for sterile neutrinos. The reactor neutrino anomaly is somewhat challenged by the fact that in an attempt to explain this bump seen in the Reno and Diabay and double show experiments, people have re-examined this extrapolation of the electron spectrum observed in the Bill spectrometer at ILL to neutrino spectra and discovered that if you just go look at what we know about the nuclei, you don't get in agreement with that. So maybe this experiment is something we need to think about revisiting. But in any case, it would have to, if you see this deviation here, you know, this deviation is sort of 6%. So it has to call into doubt the claim 2% error in this. So I think this one has just gone away, basically. But there's still these. So what do we say about sterile neutrinos? I'd say if you look at all that data, it's a bit ragged. No bit of it by itself is convincing. And furthermore, it's not completely consistent. Appearance and disappearance is intention. And astrophysical results are somewhat ambiguous on whether they would like a sterile neutrino or not. However, bottom line is sterile neutrinos are a generic prediction of many beyond the standard models, although mass is almost unpredicted. And so we should look at what experiments we could do to extend our sensitivity to the existence of sterile neutrinos. To forget whether you're convinced by any of that evidence or not, we should sterile neutrinos is an interesting question totally apart from these experimental hints. And so we should look at if we can find experiments that will significantly extend our sensitivity to the existence of sterile neutrinos. So many ideas have been proposed. Katrin gives you some additional sensitivity. There's many others. Just point out, at Fermilab, they're in the process of proposing a short baseline experiment supposed to come to the pack in January, which would give some additional sensitivity and to the claims, but you know, a modest improvement over what where we are now. So you might want to do something more ambitious. A proposal at Oak Ridge, the OSC-SNS, is to redo basically LSND and Karman using muons from neutrinos from stop pi decay. This gives a greater, you have to compare the plots directly, but this is about a factor 3 or 4 below what the short baseline at Fermilab would go. Just as an aside, if Oak Ridge doesn't want to play, consider the ESS. They seem to want to do a neutrino experiment. I have my own preferred sterile neutrino experiment. I'll come back to that. I do have one challenge. I issued this challenge in Neutrinos 2014. I haven't had a response yet. We currently look at the sensitivities and compare sterile neutrinos based on 3 plus 1 model, which is already almost ruled out by experiment. So is there some more model-independent way to compare different experiments looking for sterile neutrinos? I note that the theorists are going to be here till December the 20th, so you've got lots of time to think about this. And I'm disappointed that no one answered me the last time. So next time I give a summary talk of a conference, which the way things have been going recently will be next week. Hopefully you'll have something by then. Now, back to the biggies. What is the mass, or the biggies for me anyway, what's the mass hierarchy? Many have been called, perhaps some will be chosen to attack this. There are atmospheric results, as John pointed out in his talk. There are effects, MSW resonance going through the Earth's core that can potentially be seen in atmospheric neutrinos. So Hyper-K would be very sensitive to this. It's one of the main reasons to build this new ICAL in India. There's the prediction, there's the attempt to see basically the same effect, although instead of seeing it in electron neutrino appearance, but seeing in muon neutrino disappearance by Pingu and Orca. An attempt, a desire to look at this modulation of the disappearance in reactor neutrinos with this huge detector at Juno or Reno. This is very ambitious. It requires 3% energy resolution in a 20 kiloton organic scintillator, but not to be deterred, our colleagues on Juno have started anyway, and let's very much hope they succeed. In my view, the measurement of theta-1-2 alone justifies the project, so the mass hierarchy is a bonus if they can get it. Of course, you could probe all three of these, as we've heard, with long baseline. I won't go into the details because we've all heard it a dozen times. I mean, long baseline has a long history. We've seen tau appearance in OPERA. And Minos has been measuring muon neutrino disappearance and electron neutrino appearance for many years. Now we've got the new NOVA experiment online. And here are some of these events that we saw earlier. And they can see a peak in the neutrino events picked in time with a beam. But they've just picked out the events, not used the time at all here, and you immediately get the in-time bit jump out. Minos Plus snuck in there. The detectors are complete, as we heard. I already said that. Running out of time. Of course, you saw here at the conference, we're getting more data from Daya Bay and the other reactor experiments, steadily increasing precision on theta-1-3. That's useful when we include compare it to the results seen from T2K, new E appearance and new mu disappearance results, which and now analyzed and combined fits allow T2K to be sensitive to theta-1-3. You compare that to the results from the reactors, and the tension between them gives you this currently weak indication of non-zero CP violation, but I wouldn't get very excited about that. Now, as we speak, actually, the experiment has come back up and is now running in anti-neutrino mode, so we should get some additional information. But as you know, even if you take NOVA and T2K out to their limit of sensitivity, you have relatively limited sensitivity to CP violation, at most a few sigma, so we're gonna need a bigger experiment. And you all know these different experiments have been proposed. I won't go through the details. The physics is compelling. The question is which to build. My answer, as you've heard before, is to build both LBNF and Hyper-K. I think the scientific case for two complementary experiments is compelling. Having two complementary experiments guards against spurions and anomalies in a field which has been littered with them throughout my entire career. We believe the existing oscillation results where we have multiple complementary observations, right? So theta-1-2, we see solar neutrinos in reactors Theta-1-3 we see in accelerators and reactors. Theta-2-3 we say in accelerators and atmospheric. We have more than one observation of every oscillation we believe exists, right? That's more difficult to do to get multiple observations of CP violation, but at least if we had both of these, we could see both the spectral distortion and the huge difference in neutrino and antineutrino rates you get in hyper-K. So I think that's why we should do them both. And the two detectors have very different non-accelerator capabilities, in particular different sensitivity to proton decay. And furthermore, I think we'll need we don't want the community to come down to just one experiment. So I think we'll need the community in the future. So I have some good news to report from today. The UK groups have bid to do R&D on both LBNE and Hyper-K over the next 3 years, and against their better judgment, I mean, we were stunningly endorsed, and the Science Board has recommended almost full funding for both of these R&D efforts. And so the UK continues to push this. The upcoming meetings on internationalizing LBNE to turn it into LBNF at CERN Fermilab will no doubt be very important, so help spread the word. Should get the best possible attendance. Okay, so now just a few words, because I've run out of time, on neutrinos as probes. Probing the most energetic places in the universe, I just think this one's so cool. You got to say it. These ice cube events that have been spotted now, you heard quite a bit of discussion on that, so I won't go through it. But, you know, I've been hearing about this since I was an undergraduate, when some people started DuMond. And it's a real pleasure to see finally we've established, we haven't, but some very hardworking people have established high energy neutrinos coming from the cosmos. Unfortunately, no statistically significant correlation to anything. And so the thing I'm convinced of, and Antares is also in on the game, is that we will need bigger experiments in the future. And so there are a number of plans to build much larger experiments to get a larger collection of events to compare. And I think the whole community should work very hard to support that and make sure it happens. We should once again bang on our funding agencies to make sure that happens. I note that neutrinos are an excellent probe of nuclei. You could have a whole conference on this, and I've been to many. The only point I want to make here is that all of this discussion of measuring CP violation in long baseline neutrino oscillation experiments is dependent on knowing cross-sections of neutrino processes to a hell of a lot better precision than we know them today, right? In the neutrino data on nuclei was crap up until about 5 years ago. There was a couple of hundred events hand-scanned out of bubble chambers. You know, good luck estimating the systematics on that, right? So it's not surprising that the models that were in use at the time were not very sophisticated, because why would you put a huge amount of effort to developing a highly sophisticated model if you have 200 events of unknown systematic errors to compare them to? Now we have huge data sets from Mini-Boon, from Minos, now from TDK, and from NOVA. We're getting these huge sets of data, and what we find is, and I've sat through meeting after meeting on this, you look at all the distributions, you take the models, and you can't get the lines to go through the points, right? And so actually, our errors haven't got much better. Our data is vastly better, but our errors haven't got much better, because, you know, you've got your points like this, and the line is like this, and so you have to put the line there, and then you run the line up here, and you got these tiny little error bars here, and you got the tiny little error bars on the line, and you do this, and so you end up with the same error. Wow, that's unlikely. I am almost done. So this needs a lot of effort, and what it principally needs is theorists, all right? And I say that in this audience because we have a great deal of difficulty talking young theorists into working on this sort of thing, because they think, oh gosh, intermediate energy nuclear physics, that's sure going to get me a job, isn't it? And so instead they go off and simulate some more supersymmetric models to compare to ATLAS, okay? And they come up with a new corner of parameter space that hasn't been studied yet. And they study it. And lo and behold, they find it predicts things that Atlas doesn't see. And so they can put a limit on a plot, bam, and they get a job. Okay? So it is our fault. We're the people who drive our departments to decide who to hire. So we should drive our departments to make sure that there are some young theorists, right, who are engaged in this, because otherwise, all of that effort to build Hyper-K and LBNE are not going to get you anything. Because if the line doesn't go through the points, the errors aren't getting any smaller. I don't care how much data we take. Okay? Here is my choice for what I would build to solve that problem and also to do the sterile neutrinos. I would build NewStorm. You know what it is. I don't have time to discuss it. To my mind, any claim of CP violation by the appearance of NuE requires an independent measurement of the cross-sections for NuE, which means you have to have a NuE beam. This is the only way we know how to get one. It also keeps us on track for a neutrino factory, which I think someday we will want, but probably not in my career. However, it costs hundreds of millions of dollars that we don't have. We don't have it at Fermilab, and we don't have it at CERN. So can we have NuStorm? Well, here's something that's happening in China. This is something Yifang talks about. They're building a proton driver, or they're planning to build a proton driver, a 15-megawatt CW proton driver for their ADSR program. And Yifang wants to make a new muon beam off of it, and his plan is to aim it at Juno. Now, this is an interesting idea, okay, but this detector doesn't sign select. And so, therefore, having a non-sign select detector on a muon beam is pretty useless. So this is an interesting idea, but that's the wrong detector. On the other hand, if instead of putting it at 150 kilometers, you put it at 150 meters, the NuStorm detector is probably the right detector, and you can probably do all the physics of NuStorm with this thing. So I call the attention of the community to this opportunity. If someone else is going to build all this stuff for you, wouldn't you want to build that and do this experiment there for a lot less than $300 million? So conclusions. Neutrino mass and mixing remain the only laboratory physics beyond the standard model. We should be bullish in pushing the case to fully explore this. We need to do these experiments. Okay? We should also take advantage of neutrinos to probe other phenomena, like the origin of cosmic rays, the sun, supernova, and so on. Right now, things are very tight in money, but as you know, I'm sitting on the CERN SPC. I see that as the LHC program becomes better defined, particularly when they really start looking at the date when they will pull the plug out of it, have to decide what they will do with CERN after that, we may find the world becomes more open to ambitious new projects in our field. So we should be ready by having a full suite of things to propose and by just keep banging on people to admit that we have to measure all of these things or we won't be done. Thanks.
Thank you for a very comprehensive talk, which essentially effectively summarized the conference in the absence of conference. So, question, please.
Well, it's not really a question, just you said this about using neutrino properties as input to cosmology.
Yes.
Instead of output. You are in good company. Zeldovich said the same thing a long time ago.
Thank you. Other questions? Please.
So I'll just add, you didn't say anything about supernovae. And one of the things that I particularly take away from this conference, with all the nice talks about the progress and calculations and so on, is that we're never going to, not soon going to get anywhere with the supernova business. As we sit here with the experiments that are now on, up and running and planned, what we really need is to go for a megaton detector with a 10 MeV threshold, something like that, even better. And then we get to seeing the supernovae from the starburst galaxies and start to get some numbers to keep our theorist friends busy.
Yes.
But we're, as things stand now, we're not going to get anywhere with that, except we'll get one supernova soon, and then we'll all go, wow.
Yes, it's. I think you're right that it's very important to feed the theorists enough stuff to get them to have the models converge to the point that we have strong predictions before we see the supernova. Because otherwise, if they've already got the data in front of them, they'll tune the models to reproduce it, and they'll tune them in four different ways, and we'll have no way to test.
Sergey?
I was wondering, I mean, what is the original idea behind this Yifang Wang moment?
Talking to Yifang, as far as I can tell, it was, you know, they wanted to do something, you know, they wanted to use this proton driver to do some neutrino physics. And so this was at New Fact 2013 was in Beijing, right? It was the New Fact in Beijing, I think it was 2013. And he just sort of threw this idea out, you know, not with this stuff on it, but just like this. He just sort of threw this out and said, look, you know, we've got this, we could build this, right? And we, so we can make it incredibly intense. I mean, if you run the numbers, it's in absolutely staggering in neutrino intensity. And you could aim this at, well, he said Juno because, you know, that's the experiment he has. And he'd basically just put this out to the community, you know, can you do anything with this? Is this something you want? And so this is me responding, well, no, I can't think what you would do with this because you don't have sign selection in the detector. So I don't see what you can measure with that, but I certainly see what you can measure with this. So... unless you can magnetize Juno, but God, Juno's going to be hard enough.
Other questions?
So I'll ask one on the cross sections. So the first question is, do you really want the people who do MSSM all their lives to start working on the cross sections and rely your experiments on that? Probably not, right? Then the second thing is, you know, there will be some clever neutrino nuclear theorists who will say that give us the money and we can compute everything. But the more you look into that, the more you realize how shaky that is. So the real question is there a feasible experimental program where you can benchmark enough things that you can make a robust oscillation measurement, not relying on a model of pions going through argon nuclei and so forth? Is that possible, or is it that...
I mean, basically, look, there's two ways to do, you know, if you want to think about it, the two ways you can analyze a long baseline experiment is the TDK way and the Minos way, right? So Minos builds, as far as they can, an identical near detector and an identical far detector, and you run the same beam through both, and then in each detector you measure a convolution of the beam flux, the cross-section, and the detector response. You assume in this, you know, where in between the two measurements you have the oscillations, which is what you want to know. You assume that the beam flux, cross-section, and detector response are identical in the two cases, and so you can compare them directly, okay? In that model, you don't need to know what the cross-sections are, okay? Then there's a TDK way to do it, which was, you know, sort of almost forced on us by circumstances, which is... you have a very different near and a far detector, so you have a model of the beam, and then you have to separately work out the flux cross-section and detector response so that you can take the near detector results and extrapolate them to the far detector results. Naively, you would certainly want to do the first rather than the second. The only problem is, at the few percent level, the first is impossible, right? Because the beam isn't the same near and far. Right? The detectors are never going to be the same near and far. So in the end, you are always driven to the second model. Any experiment we do in the future will use the second model primarily. You have to independently understand your beam flux, your detector response, and your neutrino interaction properties. Can you come up with some parameterization of neutrino interactions, which is independent of any theoretical understanding of what's happening in the nucleus? That just depends on some set of parameters, and then work them all out from experiment, and then somehow extrapolate that far to the detector. I don't know if you can do that. I think that'd probably be harder than, you know, because nuclear models are actually pretty good these days at predicting lots of very complicated things like spins and, you know, parities of high-lying states and that sort of thing. You would think that if they applied that level of ingenuity to just neutrino cross-sections, we could get a lot better results. No, I'm not talking about getting the supersymmetric people of this world to switch. What I'm talking about is not having 26 supersymmetry people on your theory faculty. We can have 25 supersymmetry people on your theory faculty and one person whose specialty is this, and that's what they've worked on you know, their whole career, and so we have to grow some new ones. That's what I would predict. I don't think, I mean, compared to some of the theory we have beaten, I don't think this is that hard. I could be wrong, but certainly if nobody's working on it, we won't make it any better, that's for sure.
I think, last question.
People have been studying low-energy electron nuclear scattering,
yep.
And some of those people are converting themselves, the theorists,
yes.
Nuclear
yes.
Theorists, are converting themselves and putting a gamma 5 and all the rest of it in to try
yep.
And calculate neutrino nucleus scattering.
Yes. Oh, yeah, no, it certainly happens. You know, look, I'm not the only person in the world who knows this is a problem. Of course, there are people doing it, but I'm just saying we should encourage that. And one of the ways we can encourage it is by offering some of those young people a job.
In the U.S., we have a problem in any neutrino theorist.
Mm-hmm.
There are very few neutrino faculty in the U.S., and we're not producing any neutrino theory graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think we have to move on.
Sorry.
So let us thank Dave again.